Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more.
Straight talk.
No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
April Fool's Day, 2015. Good morning, Talking Law fans. This is your host, Dan Hochheiser, criminal defense attorney in New York City, broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. We have a great show for you today. Talking Law Radio is here to entertain you, educate you, and include you in the conversation of the important legal issues of the day. Talking Law is an interactive show. We want to hear from you. Send me an email, talkinglaw@gmail.com. No G in Talking Law, talkinglaw@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. Like our Facebook page, please, facebook.com/talkinglaw. Last week's show was a particularly useful show for lawyers who represent those accused of drunk driving and for laymen interested in how to handle an encounter with the police in the event you are pulled over on the road while driving. Check out last week's episode featuring Albany DWI attorney Peter Gerstenzang, author of Handling the DWI Case in New York. You can find all our prior podcasts at blogtalkradio.com/talkinglaw or on iTunes. Today's show is no fooling matter, even though it is April Fool's Day. We are going to try something a little bit new today. We're going to expand. We're going to add a little sports feature to the show. We figured if the New York Times and other straight newspapers and media outlets can have sports, why can't Talking Law Radio have a sports segment? So we have a jam-packed show for you today. We have not one guest for you, we have not two, but we have a triple today, all for the low, low price of free. If it's free, it's for me. What's our schedule today? First, we're going to talk to Gary L. Hayward, former corrections officer and inmate. Will speak to us about his new book, Corruption Officer, which details corruption inside Rikers Island, New York City's largest jail. Then we will go to Beth Karras, who will fill us in on the details of the Amanda Knox murder case. And we will then get to Mookie Wilson, former New York Mets center fielder. Will give us the inside scoop on what he was really thinking during the 1986 Mets championship season and what life has been like since baseball ended for him. We will then answer the question of the day, and that will be a show. So, let's get to the question of the day. Question: what is the difference between a jail and a prison? That question is for everybody except Gary Hayward, who knows the answer. Who is Gary L. Hayward? Gary L. Hayward was born and raised in New York City's Polo Ground projects in Harlem. At the age of 19, he joined the United States Marines and became a decorated war veteran by serving in Desert Storm, Desert Shield operation in 1990-1991. After receiving an honorable discharge, he served as a New York City corrections officer, working 10 years at Rikers Island. In May of 2006, Gary was arrested and convicted for selling drugs throughout the Rikers Island jail. During his incarceration, Gary developed a passion for writing and penned his memoir, Corruption Officer. He was released from prison in 2008 and currently works for the city of New York. Gary Hayward, are you with me?
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm all right, sir.
Very good. Gary, thanks for taking the time out to be on the program. I really appreciate it. I read your book, which I enjoyed very much. It's really well done. It is a true slice of life story about the inside account of a corrections officer inside Rikers Island Jail and how you became powerful inside the jail and then got caught up in illegal activities and became an inmate yourself. So before we talk about the book, please tell us a little bit about yourself. How were you raised? Where were you raised? Who raised you? And what was your environment like growing up in Harlem?
Well, sir, I was born and raised here in New York City. I was born in Harlem Hospital. I was raised in the Polo Ground Projects, located on 155th Street and 8th Avenue. I was raised by a single parent, by my mother, you know, my siblings, my brother and my sister. And, of course, you know, life was kind of rough growing up in the projects in the city hood in New York City.
I bet. And when did you join the New York City Department of Corrections?
June 1997, sir.
All right. And what special challenges did you face coming from the modest beginnings that you were raised in, the, you know, rough and tumble area, and then you became part of the system as a corrections officer? How was that given your prior relationships in your neighborhood?
Well, it was rough. Well, in my neighborhood, obtaining a city job is like hitting the lotto. So when I came out the military, you know, seeking employment, you know, the first thing that the only thing that was available at the time was security jobs. So, and striving to do better for myself and my family, you know, to be a corrections officer. And some of the obstacles were that, you know, finances, because when you become a correction officer, you have to fork out a lot of money for uniforms right at the front and stuff like that. And then living in the neighborhood that I lived in, when they do their background check, you have to be squeaky clean. And sometimes that's hard to do growing up in the neighborhood that I grew up in.
But you managed to do that. As far as I understand from reading your book, you had no criminal record when you applied to the corrections department. Is that right?
That was true, sir.
So you basically threaded the needle, given the place you grew up. Everybody around you had been in and out of the system, and you got this lottery ticket job with the city, working for the New York City Department of Corrections, and for a period of time, you served legally. You didn't commit any crimes as a corrections officer. How long were you an honest corrections officer, so to speak?
Sir, I can say roughly about 3 years, because that's when I went through divorce and child support.
All right. And for that three-year period, describe what the job was like. What was the atmosphere inside Rikers Island when you were doing your work as a corrections officer in terms of your dealings with other corrections officers, you're dealing with the inmates, you're dealing with the bosses there? Take us through those 3 years before you got involved in the criminal activity.
Well, when you first get on the job, you're still learning. You know, they teach you the basics in the academy. And then once you get inside the jail, you're learning as you go. So you encounter officers that have been there a while, that show you things. You encounter, if you're not used to being around inmates, shocking situations that inmates do, which I in detailed in my book, with mentally challenged inmates or inmates that's there for serious offenses. You get a lot of help from the other officers, but then sometimes it's a lot of animosity amongst officers, you know, as in any jobs loop, sometimes petty conflicts and stuff like that. But overall, it's a heightened alert. I personally was scared, you know, going inside the jail for the first time, and, you know, you have to make that decision on whether you're really going to keep this job in this environment, because at any moment, anything can happen, fights break out, stabbing, slashings, et cetera. And if you're not used to that type of environment, it could really be it could really shake your world up.
And what's interesting is, you know, you think about Rikers Island, and most people, I think, have the impression that if you're a big, strong guy, if you're from a nasty neighborhood, or I shouldn't say nasty, you know, a working class neighborhood, maybe a poor neighborhood, that people are not scared. But You were a big guy. You was what, 6'4", 250, something like that, 270?
I was 270, sir.
Yeah, so you were a big guy, and even you were scared going into Rikers Island. And how long did you remain scared? Were you scared every day going to work, or did there come a time when your fears subsided?
Well, your fear does subside after a while, after you learn the routine. But after, when you first get on the job, your fear comes and goes. Like my very first week, I was in fear. I was on guard at all times. And then I was broken in or trained by a female, wasn't no taller than like 5'1", had a little age on her. She had salt and pepper hair, and I've seen how she controlled the inmates and did the job. Not knocking any female, but I figured me being the size that I am, then the job is more about technique than your size or your physical appearance. So at that point, you know, when you start learning the ropes and you learn the routine, it's not that you get comfortable, because you're never supposed to get comfortable on that job. It's just that you get a sense of how things are run, and then that fear subsides, and then you just buckle down and you do the job. You learn the job and you do the job the best of your abilities.
It's interesting, Gary, that you say that this 5'1" female corrections officer showed you that it's not necessarily the size of the dog in the fight, so to speak, but the size of the fight in the dog. And it's true, I think, a lot in life. And as a lawyer, I know this in the courtroom, it has a lot to do about attitude and confidence. And people should keep that in mind, I think, in all walks of life. You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Gary Hayward, former New York City corrections officer and inmate, and he is the author of Corruption Officer. Gary, where can people get your book? Can they get it at Amazon.com and bookstores?
Yes, it's in bookstores everywhere. It's in bookstores everywhere and Amazon.com.
It's an excellent book. I read it. If you want to know the inside scoop on what happens inside Rikers Island, you have to read this book. So go get Corruption Officer by Gary Hayward at Amazon or at your local bookstore. Gary, let's go to the pivotal moment in your career. There came a time when you crossed the line from honest public servant to corrupt corrections officer. Take us through the events that caused you to step over that line.
Well, it was a time period, a bad time in my life when I made some bad decisions, because I felt my back was against the wall. I was going through a divorce, a rough divorce, which was topped by child support. And then I was hit with the arrears, everything all at once. And then that led to repossession of my vehicle and garnishment for my pay. So I felt my back was against the wall with child support. And then I had a girlfriend, and she came up pregnant, and I didn't want to go through any more with the system of child support. And that's when I turned to the dark side to try to compensate my income.
And what was the first illegal act you committed as a corrections officer?
Well, the first act, well, as a correction officer, you're not supposed to give inmates anything, stick of gum, extra meal. You're not supposed to give them. You're only supposed to give them what they're entitled to. The first act was, at the time, smoking was allowed in city facilities. So I had gave an inmate some cigarettes. And at the time, cigarettes was perfectly all right inside the jail, because the inmates could go and buy their own cigarette from the commissary. But within that cigarette that I got from his sister, because I knew him for a long time, it was marijuana inside the cigarette. So that was the first illegal act that I committed, unknowingly to me, that was marijuana inside the cigarette. But then after a while, Mayor Bloomberg banned smoking in all city facilities, which opened up a black market for cigarettes throughout the jail.
So the first time you actually dealt drugs to an inmate as a corrections officer, that was a situation where you picked up a carton of cigarettes or so from somebody in your old neighborhood, and they slipped in some marijuana, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And that, did that sort of make you feel as if, well, I've already done it. I might as well ratchet this up and there's money in it, and then your illegal activities escalated?
That's exactly what happened. So when I was doing it, I was doing it for the need to get money. And when I didn't get caught, when nobody was alarmed, when nobody was alerted to my activities, that's when it escalated to cocaine and other stuff.
When you say other stuff, well, let's talk about the cocaine first. Tell us about the dealing of cocaine. Tell us how your drug dealing worked. Where'd you get it, and who'd you deliver it to, and how'd you get paid?
Well, it was a number of places. Well, I'm not going to say anybody, but it was a number of places that I knew to get cocaine. What I would do with the inmates, amazingly to me, inmates off the visit can receive cash money and be walking around with money inside the jail that they might have smuggled in from somebody that comes to visit them. So once an inmate asked me for some drugs, I would retrieve the money from him, then go get the drugs and deliver it to him.
And how did you deliver drugs to an inmate when there are other corrections officers around, other inmates around? I mean, how did you get that done without getting caught for a few years?
Well, with officers, they live for integrity. They live for the fact that you took an oath, and they expect you to uphold that oath. So the suspicion of anybody, any officer, bringing drugs inside the jail is minimum to somebody suspecting a civilian guy coming inside the jail. So what I would do, sometime I would have it in my pocket, on my person, in my uniform, and I will walk right through the front entrance of the jail undetected because I'm an officer. So that made it easier for me.
And then once you got past the security, how did you actually deliver it to the inmate?
Well, the inmates is in my housing area, in which I control. So it was just easy as letting the inmate out of his cell and giving him the product in which he paid for.
And there's no – what struck me, and I've spent a fair amount of time visiting clients inside Rikers Island, but, I mean, it seems to me that there must be video surveillance inside Rikers Island. Wouldn't some of these transactions be picked up on cameras?
Well, there are cameras throughout the jail, but there are blind areas in which there are no cameras, such as the inmate shower area. And in the housing areas themselves, there are no cameras. So anything, any transaction, anything can happen inside the housing area, and there's no cameras to pick it up or verify it. Now, as you walk in the corridor, the front entrance, in certain areas inside the jail, they have cameras.
I see. So let's change subjects a little bit from drug dealing to pimping, to selling sex inside the jail. Tell us about how you developed this business selling female corrections officers to inmates who paid for sex.
Okay. In the Rikers Island environment, there are females there that are having sex of their own free will. There were females there that were getting paid for sex before I even knew that they were doing anything. But once I got wind of it and we had a discussion, because people feel that inmates inside jail don't have any money. There are some inmates who do have a means to get to some finances. So what happens is, if a female makes an arrangement to have sex with an inmate, they make an arrangement to get payment first from maybe the inmate's family or via Western Union to somebody, and then at the opportune time, when nobody's around, when the cameras are not around, or maybe sometime most likely on a midnight tour, they have sex with the inmate, and they already got paid for it, and it goes on undetected.
And not only you describe not only the situation with female corrections officers selling sex to inmates, which you profited off, according to your book, supervising the process, but there's also, you describe quite a bit of corrections officer on corrections officer sex while they are on the job supposed to be watching the inmates.
Yes, sir. It's like this, and I'm sure most law enforcement people understand what I'm saying. A lot of civilian people don't understand, as a correction officer, you're mandated to do mandatory overtime. Some correction officers have female partners, male and female partners, that have been working together for years, and they spend more time at work than they do at home, and this is how sometimes relationships develop inside the jail. So when you have two people in a close quarter place, it may be the midnight, or it just may be opportunities where inmates are locked inside their cell and the feelings have developed for one another, and they get stuck a lot of times. When I say stuck, that means that they do their 8-hour shift and they want to go home, and then it's mandatory that they have to stay there another 8 hours to maybe 11 o'clock at night or even overnight. And this is how relationships develop, because you get used to a person, you get to know a person, and then sexual relations happen.
Okay, you're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Gary Hayward, former corrections officer at Rikers Island, and inmate who was convicted for dealing drugs inside the jail, and author of the book Corrections Officer, which is available at Amazon and local bookstores. Gary, at the end of your excellent book, which I urge everybody to go out and get, you provide 5 bullet point recommendations on how to prevent a corrupt corrections officer, how to prevent a corrupt corrections officer. So let me ask you about some of them. First, you say that there should be random strip searches performed on officers as they enter the facility, or at least they should be randomly patted down. How would that help prevent corrupt corrections officers?
The reason being is because a corrections officer hides behind the fact that he's going to get the benefit of the doubt because of his integrity and he took the oath. Now, back in the day when it wasn't so rampant and contraband wasn't so rampant throughout the jail, maybe that would uphold. But right now, since it's rampant throughout the jail that every time you look around in the paper, a correction officer is bringing in contraband, it's because they're comfortable, meaning they know that their person is not going to be searched by an officer. So if it's put into correctional laws as far as having a job, that randomly I can be strip searched to see if I'm bringing contraband inside the jail, that would spark precaution in someone who is doing it, and they would stop, or hopefully it would slow it down, because any day they can randomly be picked to be searched and they may get caught. So the fear of getting caught is like right now, as a correction officer, they have random drug testing to see if anybody's on drugs. That means that anytime you come inside the jail, they'll tell you you have to go over to a trailer to take a drug test, and you can't leave until you take that drug test. So if you don't take that drug test, it's automatic termination from your job. So now it's put in the atmosphere that any day you could be pulled into a secluded area and strip searched to make sure that you're upholding your integrity and you're not bringing drugs in, then I think a person would think twice about bringing drugs inside the facility.
Now, Gary, you make some other excellent recommendations for how to combat this problem of corrupt corrections officers tainting the very good job that many honorable corrections officers perform on a daily basis. Before I let you go, because we're almost out of time, Gary, as a criminal defense lawyer in New York City, I have one burning question I must ask you. How come the New York City Department of Corrections cannot get an inmate to 100 Center Street, the courts, at 9:30 a.m. when court starts?
Well, it could be a number of reasons. The inmate, I had a situation before where an inmate was convicted of rape, and he was supposed to be going to get sentenced. When they don't want to do the time, they concoct all kind of various obstacles for you not to get them out their cell. You got to fight with them to get them out their cell. And then they may slip and fall and they back hurt all of a sudden. So they're not, now it's medical reasons. So it could be a number of reasons why that inmate is not there on time.
Okay, that argument is rejected. But I don't believe that part. But Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. I enjoyed this discussion. Congratulations on the book, Corruption Officer. I urge everybody to go get it. Gary, I hope you'll come back soon and speak to us again.
Anytime. Thank you for having me, sir.
Okay, take care now. Now, Mark, give me Beth Karras and give me Kiss.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
Are you recovered from your show?
I have recovered. I mean, I still have some residual effects, but it's good to have kind of my life back. After 5 months in Phoenix, and I hit the ground running for 3 weeks in rehearsals and then the performance Friday and Saturday, and I'm on to new ventures.
Fantastic. Let's talk about the new decision. Friday, March 27th, 2015, Italy's Supreme Court overturned the retrial murder convictions of Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sausalito for the 2007 throat-slashing killing of Knox's former roommate, Meredith Kircher. Beth, what was the basis for the Supreme Court's
saga.
Ruling?
Right. The seven-and-a-half-year saga for those two is over. And this was not something that the lawyers actually predicted. People who are supporters of Amanda Knox and Raffaele believe that in their absolute innocence. But the world stage, when this first happened, which was November 1st, 2007, and word got out, you know, that late that fall in the winter, people believed these two were absolutely guilty. And it was an uphill battle for supporters of the two one-time defendants to essentially prove their innocence. Italy's system is very, very different from the United States system, and they were getting retrials at an appellate level. You know, you get a new trial, it doesn't go back down to the trial court. It stays at the higher level. They were tried three times. And appellate courts can reinstate a conviction or they can issue an acquittal. And that's what happened in this case. So between, 2009 is when they were first convicted. And then an appellate court asked for independent experts, not experts hired by each side, but independent experts to look at the forensic evidence as a strength of it. And those experts came back and said, whoa, this is like not a good case. I mean, there's just nothing tying those two to a brutal, bloody crime scene that a third person who's been convicted was absolutely at, because his fingerprints and DNA and all were all over the scene, but not the other two.
You're talking about Rudy Guidi, if
Rudy
I'm pronouncing Gaudet that right.
It sounds good. Yeah, he took a plea. He took an option of a fast-track trial. So he got a 30-year sentence reduced to 16 years. And there was a time when he said those two had nothing to do with it, and then he implicates them gets a reduced sentence. And he was a man with a record, a man from the Ivory Coast who had been living in Italy for years. So this appellate court says, these two are acquitted. And that's when Amanda comes home, right? And then there's an appeal by the state, the prosecutor. And an appellate court says, wait, we disagree with the main decision. What they do is after 90 days, they issue the rationale for it. It's called a motivation. And in 90 days, we're going to see the rationale for Friday's ruling. So they issue the rationale, the motivation it's called, and this new appellate court said, no. We think the judge had some inconsistencies, and you know, there's some problems with that report. We're reinstating the conviction, and we want to take another look at it. And there was another trial, basically that third trial, which came back with the conviction. So there they were convicted again, and there was all this talk about Amanda, is she going to get extradited? But she had one more appeal, and that one more final appeal is what happened on Friday, where the court was like, that's it. You know, these guys, this is the end of the road, no more appeals, no more trials. And the court could have said that there wasn't enough evidence. The court didn't do that. The court basically did the equivalent of what happened in the United States when they said this is not just not enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but actual innocence. And that appears
you're
to be
listening
what
to Talk
did in
Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Beth Karras of KarrasOnCrime.com about the retrial murder conviction reversal in the Amanda Knox case. Beth, my understanding is that Knox's slander conviction for falsely implicating Patrick Lumumba, that stands, but I think she's already done the time for that.
She has done the time for it. That does stand, and defamation, slander, is a crime in Italy. So she has a criminal conviction there. She's done the time. That would probably it would reduce any sort of civil award if she wants to sue for a malicious prosecution or the equivalent of that. She could do it, but it would be reduced by the defamation conviction. You can't recover money there if it has been proven that you've lied or given inconsistent statements. And so her co-defendant,
Beth Karras on crime.com. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Beth, thank you as always.
All right.
I know you'll continue following the Amanda Knox case. Beth, I'll speak to you soon.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. Now, let's have Mookie Wilson.
It's so wonderful that Mookie, he's the leadoff man.
Is a native of South Carolina, is a former Major League Baseball player, known best for being an optimistic switch hitter and for his time on the world champion 1986 New York Mets. He is currently a team ambassador to the Mets and a Christian minister. Mookie, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here. Enjoyed that Elton John rendition. That's pretty nice.
Mookie, this is an honor and a privilege to have you on the show. And I just want to be a little nostalgic for a moment. To be perfectly honest, I'm a New York Yankee fan. I grew
That's
up with Reggie
Mickey
Jackson,
first.
And but I remember the 1986 World Championship Mets run like it was yesterday. And I actually, my producer had come up with another song to play as your intro, and I said, no, I need that Elton John song, because that's the song that always played in the deli when I was in high school during that 86 season, when we would have breakfast and talk about the Mets and you and Straw and Gooden and Keith Hernandez. And I love that song, and you were such a great player, so I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Mookie, you have this book out, Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets. Why'd you write the book?
I wanted people to understand the person behind the name. You know, everyone is, you know, they've heard the name Mookie, but I don't think they really understand who Mookie was. I mean, they understand, you know, what happens in the World Series and a ball player, but there was so much more to me than that. So I wrote the book for that. And I just thought that people, you know, would help someone who was in similar situations to, you know, get through life or through at least through a day a little bit better. So that's my purpose.
Now, you know, I remember as a baseball fan during that 86 season and in your career while you were on the Mets, I always viewed you, as I think a lot of other fans did, as sort of a happy-go-lucky center fielder, fast, always hustling guy who was always pleased with everything. Was that the case? Were you always happy in the clubhouse during your time during the 86 season?
Yes, I was always happy in the clubhouse. I mean, you know, I mean, you're playing baseball in New York, that was great. But there's you know, some things that happened behind the scenes that I wasn't so happy with, you know, but that was never to be, you know, it was something that was private. And so, you know, I think everyone has those moments, and I'm no different.
Okay. Will you let us in a little bit and tell us what you were a little bit unhappy about? Because I think you do talk about it in the book.
Yes, I do mention it in the book. You know, I mean, there's some times I wasn't pleased with the way I was being, you know, used. I thought that I was being underused and underappreciated as far as, you know, when it comes to performing on the field. You know, I thought that I was dealt a bad deal in terms of, you know, how do I not, you know, become, you know, how to become a part-time player. You know, being a switch hitter, I understand when guys see hits from one side, but when you're a switch hitter, you know, and why would you not continue to use and utilize that, you know, that talent? And I never really got an explanation for that. So I was unhappy about that. And basically that's really the only thing that I was unhappy was about playing time and how they were using me.
And was that issue driven by the acquisition of Lenny Dykstra?
No, I think that, you know, Lenny was going to be the person that was going to fill that leadoff spot, which is something that they desperately, you know, they felt that they needed was a more established leadoff guy, a guy that was more, you know, suited to be a leadoff guy, which I never was, by the way. You know, I've always thought that I was probably suited to be hit someplace else in the lineup, but they always asked me to lead off, so that's what I did. Lenny was just got caught in the middle of it. You know, Lenny was a great ball player, enjoyed playing with him, and I thought that he would have been a great addition to be the leadoff guy. It had nothing to do with Lenny. It was all about it was between me and the organization at the time.
Now, let's talk about the burning question that everybody has, because every time you're interviewed, and you're probably sick of talking about it, but I have to ask you about it.
Okay.
Let's talk about what does the average fan – not understand about the slow ground ball you hit through Bill Buckner's legs to win Game 6 of the 86 World Series against the Red Sox?
Wow. Oh, you know, I don't know if it's not much. I think that the thing, I don't know if they don't understand it or just choose to ignore it, is that there's so many things that happened before that ground ball. And even though he did miss the ground ball, missing that ground ball did not cost them the World Series. You know, I think
why do you say
so many
that?
Other things. First of all, we were down two runs and down to our last strike on three separate hitters. And they had to close in the game, and they could not close the game out. You know, and even after we won the World Series, I mean, even after we won Game 6, there still was a Game 7 that they were leading, you know, in the game by three runs, as a matter of fact. And they still could not close it out. So to say that that play cost them the World Series, I think is a vastly overstated. It helped and it you know it played a big part in it, but it did not cost them the World Series. I thought that there's just so many things that the team did not do; they failed to execute, and this is what cost them the series.
Now, Mookie, when did you retire?
I think 91 was my last year, and with the Toronto Blue Jays.
Okay, so you left the Mets in what year?
And I left the Mets, and I was traded in August of 89.
All right, so then in 91 you retire from the Blue Jays,
yep.
And now you're in your post-baseball life. After retiring, how was your relationship with the New York Mets? Was that always smooth sailing, or did you have some regrets about how you were treated by the Mets after you left the team?
Well, you know, it's no secret. I mean, those regrets, there were still some ill feelings there, and it was basically the same thing. It's about how I was being treated and how I was being utilized, not as a player anymore, but, you know, as a coach and, you know, even potential managing, you know, in the minor leagues and wherever else they needed me to be. I just think that I was being underutilized again. So, you know, but there again, you know, when you with an organization, you know, you pretty much that organization becomes your family, and that's the way I looked at it. And I just think that I wasn't being used enough, you know, to my satisfaction. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, that they should have done anything different. That's or for the organization to decide, but in my opinion, I felt that that should have been dealt with a little bit differently.
Let me give you some quick questions, because we don't have a lot of time left.
Okay.
Should Pete Rose be inducted into the Hall of Fame?
In my opinion, if I had to vote today, I would vote him in.
How about Barry Bonds?
Now, that's a different story. If I had to vote him in today, I would probably consider Barry Bonds. Yes, I probably would put him in also. I just for various reasons, I think that there's so many things going on in baseball today, and there's a lot worse things than steroids that's happening in the game today.
Now, going back to the 86 Mets team for a moment, what players would you say on that 1986 Mets team? You know, everybody hears about Strawberry and Gooden and Hernandez and Dykstra and Mookie. What players didn't get enough credit for the team's success?
Oh, I'm glad. Oh, what a great question. I think, you know, you don't get enough credit to guys like Sid Fernandez, who pitched some great innings for us in the World Series and did a great job for us all year. Danny Heap, who was very underrated as a guy coming off the bench, who was the guy. He was probably our best hitter coming off the bench that filled a number of roles, little first base, little outfield. Tremendous pinch hitter, just tremendous. And my personal favorite is Kevin Mitchell. I thought Kevin Mitchell was he meant so much to that club offensively. Defense, you know, he played a number of positions defensively, and his spirit and the character, you know, I just think that he was vastly undervalued. So there are some players right there that I thought that really deserved more credit than they got.
Mookie, last question, which is on every Mets fan's mind. Will the New York Mets make the playoffs this year, and why or why not?
Well, I think it's too early. I haven't seen enough of them to say. I think that their chances are pretty good because they have added that one other playoff team now, and I think that they have the young pitching is going to be very good. I think a lot of things are going to have to happen. They got to stay away from the injuries. Last year, injuries hurt us, and I think that there's a chance that they could squeak in this year, but they're going to have to be healthy to do it.
Mookie Wilson, author of Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets, a book which is an excellent read. Everybody should get it from Amazon or your local bookstore. Mookie, this was a privilege and an honor. Keep doing the great works you're doing, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us sometime.
Oh, thank you, and I'll be more than happy to.
Very good. Thank you, Mookie. All right, let's go to the answer to the question of the day. Question, what is the difference between a jail and a prison? Answer, generally a jail is a correctional facility which holds inmates temporarily until the inmate's case is resolved in the trial court or for inmates sentenced to 1 year or less, while a prison holds inmates who have been sentenced to more than 1 year. Generally, a jail is a temporary holding place, and a prison is a more permanent place for inmates. Thank you to Gary Hayward, author, corruption officer, Beth Karras, KarrasOnCrime.com for your excellent update on the Amanda Knox murder conviction reversal, Mookie Wilson, author, Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets. Thank you, Mookie. My producer, Mark Goldman, who always does such a great job. Next week, I will be busy eating matzah, observing the Passover holiday. So Beth Karras will guest host for me next Wednesday at 9:30 a.m., and we will have a great show. Please email the show with any suggestions, comments, at talkinlaw@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. Follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, HOCHHEISER. I wish you all a kosher Passover, a happy Easter, and, of course, peace and justice. Take care.